I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up in just a moment, amidst the bad news this week, U.S. soldiers who made it their mission to save a child in Iraq. But first, the number of innocent bystanders contaminated with the radioactive polonium-210 that was used to assassinate former KGB agent Alexander Litvinenko continues to grow. Seven employees of the London hotel where he met businessman Dmitry Kovtun have tested positive for low levels of polonium-210. And yesterday it was announced that Kovtun himself had developed an illness connected with polonium-210. Litvinenko was buried in a London cemetery yesterday, his coffin sealed to prevent the radiation that killed him from spreading. But the mystery continues to grow. We've been following this story with Edward Lucas, Central and Eastern European correspondent for The Economist. And Edward, the British authorities are now focused on questioning Andrei Lugovoy back in Russia. But he was also at that hotel meeting with Litvinenko and Kovtun the day Litvinenko fell ill. What more do we know about Lugovoy?
Well, what we know is that he's not well at the moment. And of course, if you're very suspicious about this, you wonder if he's really ill or whether this is just an excuse to avoid questioning. But the British police who are in Moscow at the moment have been able to interview him.
He's a former security agent, or is
exactly.
he?
Exactly. He is a classic post-communist figure. He was in the Soviet KGB. He was then in one of the organizations that succeeded it, working as a head of the bodyguard unit that protected top officials, including the Prime Minister Yegor Gaidar, who's also been taken ill recently, though he's now recovered. Then he got into some sort of trouble there and left and went into business and became a very successful businessman, owning a brewery and a security firm and some other things.
Well, we should stress, too, there are so much is coming out. The meeting that he, Lugovoy, had with Litvinenko and Kovtun, the businessman, was at a hotel that's separate from the sushi restaurant meeting where Litvinenko met with the Italian agent who's also become ill. It's just spreading so wide.
That's right, Robin. And I have to say, if you're writing this as a novel, your publisher would be saying to you by now, can you reduce the number of characters and try and keep the plot a little bit less complicated? Because it's really, even for people who follow it pretty much full time, it's getting quite hard to follow and remember who's who and what's what. But I think for the sake of convenience, we can pretty much rule out now Scaramella. This is the man who met Mr. Litvinenko in the sushi bar.
The Italian agent.
Mm-hmm. We don't know if he's an agent. We must be careful not to defame him. But he is a rather obscure figure in Italy, who's a self-styled security consultant, seems to have been mixed up in the intelligence world, though perhaps more as a fantasist than as a real operative. But he's now pretty much out of the picture. No one now suspects him of either having poisoned or indeed of having been poisoned, although he's still claiming that his life's at risk in some kind of vague sense. So now the question is, these three Russians, Lugovoy and Kovtun, who actually had a meeting, and a third one who was just was there very briefly and shook hands with Mr. Litvinenko. And what's the big question is really, was one of those two men the one that administered the poison, or was the poison administered at that meeting by somebody else, and they just picked up a dose as well?
And meanwhile, the British authorities want to meet with Lugovoy, but the Russians are insisting they'll do all the questioning. So this is becoming sort of a slight diplomatic problem.
Absolutely. Now, I think this is really now the big new twist. I think the murder investigation is pretty much going nowhere. We're going to be quite unlikely, I think, to get arrests or much cooperation from the Russian authorities going forward. But I think what is happening now is that British-Russian relations are deteriorating very fast. And as we report in The Economist this week, the British ambassador to Moscow is being hounded wherever he goes by Kremlin-sponsored thugs who interrupt him, shout at him, demand that he apologize for various obscure crimes that Britain's supposed to have committed. And we think British oil companies in Russia are going to be coming under a lot of pressure.
Edward Lucas of The Economist magazine, we will continue to touch base with you on this story because it just is intriguing. Edward, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. Bye.
Well, debate continues this week after the release of the Iraq Study Group report. But meanwhile, U.S. troops in Iraq remain on the job. And in one platoon, they felt that part of that job was to save an Iraqi child. We want to tell that story today. The 1st Battalion, 25th Marine Regiment out of Fort Devens here in Massachusetts, was deployed to the Anbar province near Fallujah. This summer, while searching door to door for an insurgent who'd just blown up a Humvee, Navy medic Chris Walsh stopped in his tracks when an Iraqi mother came out of a room holding her seriously ill baby, seeming to ask for help. The child was suffering from a rare disease. Her bladder was actually developing outside of her body. It's called bladder extrophy. It leaves her prone to infection. What Chris Walsh and his unit did next became a mission of a very different sort. We want to speak with Kevin Cullen, who has written this story for the Boston Globe. A little later, we're going to be speaking to Chris Walsh's mother. But Kevin, you write, when Chris Walsh first came across the baby, the child looked as though her insides had been turned inside out. Her name was Miriam, and she looked at him with dead eyes. Can you give us an idea of the living conditions that baby Miriam faced?
Miriam lived like a lot of these. This was basically a row of ramshackle houses in a part of Fallujah in which there was no running water. There was no electricity in these homes. And she basically lived in a shanty.
Well, Chris Walsh would find out what her illness was when he announced to his platoon later that he was going to do something about this child. And then he found that someone actually had a relative here in Massachusetts who had the same illness.
Yeah, it was. I talked to several of the Marines and corpsmen, the Navy corpsmen. In the Marine units, all the medical people tend to come from the U.S. Navy. And they were all standing around eating, and that's when he just got up at dinner and just said, listen, we're going to try to help this kid get her to the States and get her the medical care she needs. And there was a major from Maine, Mike Henderson. He said, hey, my nephew had that condition. And we took him to Mass General, and that's where they fixed him up. So there was a doctor in the 25th, a guy named Sean Donovan. And Captain Donovan just basically started, you know, doing a search engine, Google or Yahoo or whatever, and Rafael Pieretti's name came up because he is a Venezuelan-born surgeon at Mass General who is one of just a handful of surgeons in the United States who specializes in this pediatric condition.
Well, meanwhile, Chris Walsh, who started all of this, and some of his colleagues, Lance Corporal Eric Valdepenas, Corporal Cody Hill, they would go out at night with their infrared glasses on because it's so profoundly dangerous, and they'd park their cars, hide them, and then walk, as you describe a scene of them walking these routes to go take care of her at night.
Yeah, because they were very concerned about her developing an infection that could very quickly kill her. They were going out at least once a week on these missions. It involved about 12 Marines and corpsmen, and that they several Humvees would be parked. And they were very concerned about being ambushed. Frankly, they didn't know if the family would be infiltrated. They didn't know if somebody would lay an ambush for them.
And this family didn't speak English.
They didn't speak any English, no. I think the heart of this story is human beings relating to each other. I don't think language was such a big deal with these people. I think the family sensed immediately the way that Chris Walsh responded to the child, that they wanted to help, that they wanted to help Miriam.
Well, Chris's dream of getting her out of the country got stalled in bureaucracy. He found out, and we find out, that more than 5,000 Iraqis were already trying to leave the country to get medical care.
They were basically told, get in line. In terms of seriousness, the threat to her life, Miriam wouldn't have been near the top of the list for a lot of the Iraqis who want to get out and get the medical care they need in the Western world.
Even though she was very sick, I mean...
She was very sick, and yeah. I mean, like I said, it's a very inexact science, but I mean, the doctors who saw her when she came said she was very listless, she was very, very, you know, malnourished. Dr. Ronan from Mass General didn't believe she would have lived a year.
Well, then we come to the part of the story that is just, I mean, you kind of feel that you know it's coming, and maybe listeners do as well, because we're not talking to Chris Walsh right now. Because September 4th, Labor Day, a bomb exploded under the Humvee that he was in. Eric Valdepenas, Jared Shoemaker, and Chris were all killed.
Yeah. It was, I remember talking to a number of the Marines in that, just how, obviously, these guys are used to death. This battalion lost 11 Marine and corpsmen in just a seven-month rotation through there. That, you know, basically out of 1,000 guys, 11 of them were killed and 80 were injured. They're used to this. But they said this was different because I think Eddie Ewing, the sergeant, described them as a humanitarian truck. they stood out among everybody else because they really did. And it, I guess it's very hard for us to understand what Fallujah's like, Robin. Mm. It's probably the toughest place with Baghdad to be in Iraq, and the Marines particularly have been taking hits there. And yet these guys seemed to go out of their way, and particularly Chris Walsh. That Chris Walsh was, you know, the medic with this truck, and he just could not go by people that he saw on the street, civilians, Iraqi civilians who were hurt or clearly had substandard medical care. He would stop and ask the platoon leader, Eddie Ewing, to stop the patrols, and he would get out in just extraordinary risk to himself and do these impromptu sidewalk clinics and help people. I remember Eddie, I didn't put it in the story, but it was one of those stories that really stuck with me. Eddie Ewing told me that they were driving through one of the worst parts of Fallujah. It is known as a banded area. They get hit there all the time. And he said Chris begged him to stop because there was an old man he saw lying on the side of the road. And the guy had apparently just, all it was a broken leg, but he had gotten very substandard care. They had stapled the leg together very rudimentarily. And the stapling had led to an infection, and it was quite messy and quite a bad infection. And Eddie Ewing said that Chris begged them to stop, and they stopped, and the Marines always backed him up, and they took up cover positions. He got out and tended to the old guy. He cleaned out the wound as best he could. He wrapped it in a clean bandage because the bandage the guy had on was filthy. And Eddie Ewing said that Chris got back in the truck and kept looking back at the old guy and said, "Geez, I wish I could do more for him." I'm sorry, Robin.
No, that's all right.
I never met the guy, and I'm tearing up because I just think that's one of the reasons I really wanted to do this story is that most Americans probably know who Lindy England is, but most of them wouldn't know who Chris Walsh is.
Lindy England, the soldier at the center of Abu Ghraib. Well, now they know because also these men who admired him so much decided to take up his cause.
Yeah.
When we picked up our Boston Globe and we saw this picture on the front page of this beautiful girl who did get here, they got her here.
Yeah, and Eddie Ewing, the staff sergeant, said that obviously their first reaction wasn't, "Oh, we got to do this." Their first reaction is they were really angry. And their first reaction, and I think was sort of a base human reaction, is maybe to retaliate, to go out there and find out the people who did this or the nearest best thing. And they were told to stand down because obviously the platoon was upset, but also, as Ewing said, that their commanding officer were very concerned that they would go out and retaliate. They got together, they sat around as a platoon, and very quickly started telling stories, and stories like that about Chris taking care of the old guy and going out of his way and risking their life. And that whole team, not just Chris, but Eric, you know, a 21-year-old kid from Seekonk who left UMass because his unit got called up. Jared Shoemaker, who was a cop in Tulsa, recently married, and Eric and Cody Hill. And Cody was a rodeo rider, a really tough kid. Eric and Cody would hide in the brush outside the house of Miriam's house and do the cover positions. And the platoon quickly decided, you know, the way we're going to honor these guys is to get baby Miriam out of here.
Kevin Cullen of the Boston Globe. When we come back, we want to hear more about those guys. We want to hear more about Miriam and speak with Chris Walsh's mom about her son. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with Kevin Cullen of the Boston Globe, who wrote a story about the 1st Battalion, 25th Marine Regiment, Navy medic Chris Walsh, who made it his personal mission to save an Iraqi child known to them as Baby Miriam, suffering from a rare disease. Then Chris and three of his team were killed when an explosive destroyed the Humvee they were riding in. That's when the rest of his platoon took up his mission, succeeded in bringing Miriam here to Massachusetts General Hospital, where she had life-saving surgery. We have Chris Walsh's mom, Maureen Walsh, standing by to join us in a second. But Kevin Cullen, first, I want you to finish your thought. How did platoon members make sure that Miriam was safe until they were able to get her out of Iraq?
There were 30 members of that platoon. Every single one of them volunteered to go out on these night missions. And it's beyond heroic what they did, how risky it was to do. And that family can't go back and tell everybody, "Wow, the Americans were so good to us," because you know what? That would put them in danger.
Maureen Walsh, this is a story, you know, that's in the newspapers, but it's primarily your story. So first of all, we're sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
And we thank you for your time. I understand that this was slowly revealed to you, this
story.
Well,
it was actually dropped in my lap with the letter that was written by Captain Donovan.
Sean Donovan, the doctor.
Yes.
What did he tell you?
He offered condolences on behalf of himself and the platoon and all the people who were in Iraq. And then he said that there was another story that I maybe hadn't heard about. And he proceeded to tell me how Miriam was found and basically what they had done and that they were going to get her out.
You're speaking to us from Overland Park, Kansas.
Yes.
And I know that, you know, you made the trip to Boston and held this little girl. I mean, what? I can't even imagine what's going through your mind.
It was more than I could have hoped for. My thoughts, I was speechless. She had been described to me as a very, very sick baby, and that's not what I saw. I think it was a job well done, and I am so glad to have been able to be there. I got to hold her. And I sort of felt like a part of Chris was right there with me.
And now I'm wondering if you're hearing, you know, so many of the other stories about your son that we've been hearing that, you know, Kevin's been struggling to tell us. I mean, he sounded like quite a guy.
He was. And I was surprised when I got the letter, but as far as what took place, I'm not surprised that Chris had a hand in it. He always wanted a challenge, and he desperately wanted to make a difference to someone. He wanted to find a purpose in life, and I think he found one. We used to talk about how you make a difference in the world, and you know, his dad and I would tell him, you have to start with one person, and he did.
I know you had a chance to meet some of Marion's family there at Mass General. What did they say to you? Probably there was some language barrier, but...
There was, but the interpreters were there, and it was very nice. They seemed very grateful, and I can't remember, maybe Kevin can make this more clear, I don't think that they had ever met Chris.
These are the grandparents, I think.
Grandparents. Mm-hmm.
The grandparents. Yeah. And they seemed to think that Chris's purpose was there for Miriam. And that's how they looked at it.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's remarkable to see her now, her life undoubtedly saved. Do you plan to stay in touch, or...
I would love to. I wouldn't want to jeopardize them in any way.
Yeah.
But I would like to know her progress. If she ever comes back to Boston, I would like to see her again.
Such a connection with your son. I'm thinking when I look at that picture of you holding Miriam that, of course, your son held her, too.
Yes.
Maureen Walsh, I just, you know, this has been a rough week.
You have no idea.
Well, I don't, and I can only guess. And I'm just wondering, you know, given that what we're hearing from the Iraq Study Group, you know, failed policy, you know, as a mother who lost a son who saved a child, how do you make sense of any of this?
Well, I do know that Chris desperately believed in America and what is being done, and he didn't believe all of the negative, and he proved it.
That's Maureen Walsh. Her son Chris died when an explosive went off under his Humvee, but prior to that he started in motion an effort that ended up saving a very small child who was brought here to Massachusetts and is now back in Iraq, Kevin?
No, she's leaving in about a week.
Who was brought...
Oh. Sorry.
Do you want to come up?
No.
You got a week to get addresses or somehow figure something out.
We're going to take care
Kevin's
of it.
Kevin's on
worry
it.
About it.
I don't have any worries.
The other thing that I just wanted to throw in there, the one thing I really enjoyed, just sitting... And I actually did not want to intrude, so I purposely sat at the end of a table. A bunch of us went out to dinner. It was wonderful to watch all of Chris's buddies, guys that had served with him in Iraq, talk to Maureen and tell her stories. And she just really seemed to light up. And Eddie Gallego, who was partnered with Chris and was an EMT in New York City, he still is. And I just got such a kick out of that because she really connected with these guys. Mm. And they were the guys, believe me, that they were the ones that wanted this story to get out. And they were the ones who, you know, really wanted to make sure that, like I said, everybody knows names like Lindy England. And they wanted to be sure that more people knew the names of Chris Walsh, Eric Valdepinas, Jared Shoemaker, and Cody Hill.
Maureen, we wish you the very best, and you know, just hope that this story of your son's sustains you somehow.
It is.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we also want to thank Kevin Cullen of the Boston Globe, who wrote about Chris Walsh, his platoon, and the reunion surviving members of the platoon had with the Iraqi child Miriam and with Maureen, Chris Walsh's mom. If you'd like to read that story, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Come for the architecture, stay for the art. Ever since Frank Gehry's metal-clad swirling design for the Guggenheim Museum opened in Bilbao, Spain, art museums have been commissioning star architects to design houses sometimes more spectacular than the collections, and cities are banking on them to draw tourists. Well, Sunday in Boston, the new Institute of Contemporary Art, or ICA, opens its doors. The $51 million waterfront building was designed by the avant-garde New York firm of Diller, Scafidio, and Renfro, and alongside the artwork hang the hopes of developers and working artists in the Boston area. Here Now's Andrea Shea has this report.
As construction crews put final touches on the new glass and steel building, ICA director Jill Medvedow explains why the move represents more than a change of address.
We've been an institution that always had to run faster and jump a little higher to get done what we needed to do. But yes, the stakes are high, and we are all hard at work with our eyes on that opening to deliver a powerful, compelling engagement and encounter with works of art. I would say it's the place where all of our artistic and civic and architectural aspirations finally merge.
And a lot rides on those aspirations. With its upgrade, the ICA's yearly budget more than doubles, going from $5 million to $11 million. The museum battled bankruptcy in the past, but $66 million from supporters in 20-plus states now fill the ICA's coffers. At the old location, attendance ranged from 25,000 to 40,000 visitors a year. The new ICA projects 200,000 people in the next 12 months. That's a lot of eyeballs. With all that attention comes a sense of responsibility, according to Medvedow, not only to the ICA, but also to the city of Boston.
I think we have great cultural capital. I hope we raise it.
Medvedow isn't alone.
The better the cultural climate in Boston, the better it is for all the players on the scene.
That's Nick Capasso, director of the Decordova Museum in Lincoln, which also features contemporary art. Capasso says the new museum significantly raises Boston's cultural capital.
The new ICA will help strengthen Boston's position in the sort of international cultural map and draw tourism from around the world to add to the tourist base that we already have that is primarily rooted in history rather than in contemporary culture. And I think in order to remain competitive, Boston has to invest as much in what's going on now as what happened here over 200 years ago.
Capasso sees the new ICA as something of a gauntlet, and he urges the city to run with the cultural momentum the art museum is generating. He points to Chicago and Philadelphia as proactive art cities. Boston, he says, isn't. But Julie Burns, director of arts, tourism, and special events for the city of Boston, says comparing those cities to this one is like comparing oranges to carburetors.
For instance, Philadelphia, they have a direct revenue stream that they can put into their cultural facilities. We, at this point, do not have that. So we have to work in different creative ways to support our cultural community, and I think the mayor has done an excellent job of doing just that.
While the city hasn't funded the museum directly, it helped secure its waterfront site. The ICA is seen as a linchpin of the city's plans to develop Boston's Seaport District that includes new hotels, luxury condos, and what's been described as a major park. But even though the new ICA promises to attract art lovers and stimulate the area, what about the thousands of working artists who actually live in this city?
You make your work, you show your work, you need opportunities to show your stuff. But at the end of the day, there is a market.
Jamaica Plain artist Matt Nash doubles as publisher of the online arts magazine Big, Red, and Shiny. He says Boston's art market is lame compared with New York's or even Chicago's, where collectors and galleries take chances on lesser-known artists. That's why so many leave Boston for greener pastures. But Nash says he and his peers could cash in on the ICA's cultural capital if more people with a serious interest in contemporary art start coming to Boston to look or to shop.
That is really exciting because the young, energetic crowd that is working in Boston has a much shorter path to travel to connect to people who might be collecting the work, who might make a long-term difference in their careers. So all of these things sort of combine in a really poor term for it might be a marketing effort to sort of change the perception that Boston is a provincial backwater.
Nash says months ago he was skeptical that the new ICA could change that perception, but now he's more optimistic. And he's thrilled that four Boston artists are being highlighted in the museum's grand opening.
Our piece on the new Institute of Contemporary Art in Boston was produced by Here Now's Andrea Shea. To see pictures of the building and the collection inside, go to our website, here-now.org. And now we have an update on some stories we've reported on recently. On Wednesday, we spoke about the high number of academics killed in Iraq, targeted by religious militias because of their secular teaching. We spoke with Shakespeare scholar Dr. Abdul Sattar Jawad, who left Iraq after his life was threatened. He's now at Duke University, one of six Iraqi academics brought to the U.S. by the Scholar Rescue Fund and the Scholars at Risk Network of Universities. Well, yesterday, two less fortunate college professors were among more than 20 people killed in a series of bombings and shootings in Iraq. Mohammed Haidar Suleiman, a professor at a sports education college, was killed when gunmen opened fire while he was driving in Mosul. And in Baghdad, a drive-by shooting killed Professor Al-Harith Abdul-Hamid, director of the Psychology Center at the University of Baghdad. Here in Boston, the family of a six-year-old girl paralyzed by a stray gang bullet when she was three is getting a car, if not the one we reported. You might remember we spoke with Tanya David about her daughter Kai. They were both relying on public transportation to get around. And another Here and Now guest, Janet Jackson Burke, a Philadelphia mom whose son had also been paralyzed by gun violence and recently died, offered Tanya her son's customized van. Well, after our conversation, Kai took a ride in a specialized van, and her mom said she didn't like it because it put her and her wheelchair way in the back, away from her mom, and it was also very expensive to insure. Well, enter Boston philanthropist David Mugar. At the urging of Boston Globe photographer Bill Brett, Mugar donated a Ford Explorer to Kai's family. It will be delivered today. And finally, the family of Helen Duncan, the last person to be convicted under the British Witchcraft Act of 1735, is campaigning to have her pardoned. We spoke about Helen back in October when we talked with Nina Chandler, author of The Strange Case of Hellish Nell, the story of Helen Duncan and the witch trial of World War II. Duncan was a Scottish medium who performed popular seances attended by London's elite. During World War II, she held one in which she announced that a British ship had been sunk, which indeed turned out to be true and something the British government had been trying to keep quiet. She was arrested and served 9 months in prison and died in 1956. Well, there's no word yet from British officials on whether she will receive her posthumous pardon. That's a quick update on some stories you're listening to Here and Now. One of college football's most coveted prizes, right up there with the lucrative NFL contract, the Heisman Trophy for college football's best player, will be awarded tomorrow. And here to talk about the contenders and the rest of the week in the world of sports is our own Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. So, Bill, who is on the short list as the most outstanding player?
Well, it's one of those very short lists, like one name. It's pretty much of a sure thing that Troy Smith, who's the quarterback at Ohio State, will win the Heisman Trophy. He's had a great year, 30 touchdowns, only 5 interceptions. Probably as important, his team has had a spectacular year, pretty much the consensus number one team in the country since the beginning of the season. Hard to see how he would be upset.
You know, here, and this is the place for it, because you're the guy who can tell me, possibly a stupid question, but I realize I don't know. Is there a second place? Do they do a list?
Oh, yeah. They always invite a couple other guys, and they reveal the votes. And sometimes, interestingly enough, the guy who wins the Heisman Trophy goes on to be a bust in the National Football League, and somebody who finished third, fourth, or fifth goes on to have a spectacular Hall of Fame career.
So who should we just keep an eye on, the second place or third? You know.
Well, the second place guy is the Notre Dame quarterback, Brady Quinn. He has set 30 different records at Notre Dame, and, not a bad football school, that Notre Dame. So 30 records there mean something.
Okay. Let's stay with college football. We have a total of 33 bowl games coming up, starting in just a week with the Poinsettia Bowl. That's Texas Christian University against Northern Illinois. And that all leads up to the national championship showdown between Ohio State and Florida on January 8th. Mm-hmm. For those of us who can't keep our flowers straight. What's worth watching, as we get to the big game?
I don't think anybody should miss the Bell Helicopter Armed Forces Bowl, because it will have the most spectacular flyover. How can it miss regard?
And who's in that?
Let's see. That would be Tulsa against Utah in picturesque Fort Worth. The Sheraton Hawaii Bowl is a must for people determined to actually attend a bowl, because who wouldn't want to go to Hawaii? And that's Arizona State against Hawaii, which is kind of a lousy deal because Hawaii doesn't even have to move to attend it. Right. Somebody from a horrible cold weather place should get to go to Hawaii on December 24th. And then there's the glorious fact that Tostitos has its name on not one but two different bowls this year, which must make the people at Doritos really jealous
and
unhappy.
Well, by the way, there was some controversy over this matchup of the 33 bowls. Is that, because of the computers and everything, is that blown over?
It will never blow over. As long as there is a bowl championship series, there will be debate about whether the bowl championship series is ever able to actually cough up a national championship game. But this is the first year in which the computer that, is such an integral part of the decision-making process for the BCS actually was heard to say, danger, Will Robinson, danger, Will Robinson, and there was smoke pouring out its ears. It was awful.
Baseball's winter meeting wrapped up yesterday in Florida. Just give us some of the highlights. We know the Red Sox, our home team here, picked up a few key players, but what else do we...
Well, the highlight, I guess, is that more money is with the great Shakespearean line, there was much throwing about of brains. There was much brainlessness, but there was a lot of throwing about of money. And, of course, nobody will know until, roughly the middle of next summer, how many of these extremely expensive free agents will, in fact, help the teams that that purchased them.
Do I understand the Yankees are trying to get a pitcher back?
Well, they're talking about Pettit coming back, which is an interesting development, since he didn't say until just very recently that he was willing to try to continue his career.
Mm. Well, we want to mention on your show this week, you're following the developing story about a new stadium for hockey's Pittsburgh Penguins. All I can think about is that animated film, Happy Feet.
Yeah, they're going to try to create happy feet and happy imaginations in the minds of their fans by putting slot machines in their arena.
Now, tell me about this. This is something most sports teams try to stay away from.
Well, this, of course, is the most amazing thing about this story to me. I've been told that the commissioner of the National Hockey League, Gary Bettman, is 100% behind slot machines at the arena, which is, as you suggest, a very bizarre development.
Well, we want to hear more about it, and you can on Only a Game every weekend. Don't miss it. Bill Littlefield talks sports and, along with Charlie Pierce, all sorts of other stuff. We love listening to it every weekend. Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The film Talladega Nights, The Ballad of Ricky Bobby, actor Will Ferrell's take on NASCAR, was a box office smash, and it's coming out on DVD next week, so we thought we'd revisit our visit with Ferrell. He co-wrote and produced the film and stars as Ricky Bobby, the wildly successful driver who counts his corporately sponsored blessings every time he sits down to say grace.
Dear Lord, baby Jesus, we thank you so much for this bountiful harvest of Domino's, KFC, and the always delicious Taco Bell. I just want to take time to say thank you for my family, my two beautiful, beautiful, handsome, striking sons, Walker and Texas Ranger, or TR, as we call them. And, of course, my red-hot smoking wife, Carly, who's a stone-cold fox.
That grunt of agreement comes from Ricky's fellow racer and second banana, Cal, played by John C. Reilly. Cal takes up with Ricky's wife after Ricky's fortunes and his race car take a turn for the worse. Ricky also loses ground to his biggest rival, a gay Formula One race driver played by British comic Sacha Baron Cohen, now better known as that pseudo-reporter from Kazakhstan, Borat. The film grossed close to $150 million, but Will Ferrell had no idea that was going to happen when the film first opened, and we sat down with him to talk about the world of Ricky Bobby.
Ricky Bobby is, he's kind of, you know, brash and cocky and southern, and he wants to either finish first or wreck trying, and that's how he kind of lives his whole life.
But he also seems to be the kind of guy that your characters seem to be, which is the kind of guy who wears his inner child on his outer sleeve.
Yeah, he's definitely, that's something I definitely like to do. Yeah, he's kind of a little boy. I mean, I like characters, too, who are really cocky, but at the same time have a little glimmer of self-doubt.
And need. I mean, I thought occasionally of Elf.
Yeah, he needs to be liked and wanted, and he kind of shows a lot of vulnerability, which is kind of funny in the context of a big, broad comedy. But, yeah, he goes kind of goes through the full circle in this movie.
Dear tiny infant Jesus.
Hey, you know, sweetie, Jesus did grow up. You don't always have to call him baby. It's a bit odd and off-putting to pray to a baby.
Look, I like the Christmas Jesus best, and I'm saying grace. When you say grace, you can say it to grown-up Jesus or teenage Jesus or bearded Jesus or whoever you want.
My friend and writing partner, Adam McKay, who's also the director of the movie, our previous film, Anchorman, we had to clear so many hurdles in getting it made because this subject matter of anchor people, news people, as a comedy, it was hard to convince studios that that was a funny thing to talk about.
Really? That strikes me as odd.
Yeah, and we kept kind of saying, well, it's not, we're not really doing it about the news. These are just silly characters. And
I should say I was one, so yeah, once.
Right. So,
makes perfect sense to me.
Exactly. Right. And so as we analyzed that, we were thinking, for our next thing, we should just pick something that everyone knows something about, and something like NASCAR, and it was kind of a joke at first because we knew nothing about NASCAR, but then as we started talking about it, we thought this is a great, no one's taking advantage of writing a comedy about the sport or in this world, and that's how it started.
Really, you knew nothing about it, which would make you one of a handful of people?
Right. One of 10 people in the country. Yeah, we knew very little other than, you know, the top drivers and Daytona and some of the bigger races, but we just pitched it as simply as, you know, I would play a race car driver. It would be, every studio wanted to be involved.
Is that because you didn't tell them that it would also feature as your foil a French gay man who tongue kisses his husband on the track?
We left that part out, yeah. We did tell them there'd be kind of a villain, so that was our villain.
You know, we were wondering, watching the movie, what kind of a wrench that threw in the whole thing and who the audience for the movie is going to be given who this character is.
Luckily for us, NASCAR was game for all of this. They read our script and they said, okay, and just be kind of true to the racing, which was one of our goals. We wanted the whatever we showed in terms of the sport to look real and intense, which is what you feel when you go to these races. You know, it kind of reflects their confidence in their sport, in their audience.
That's stunning because when we were watching it, and it was a preview audience, but it was full. Everybody's just laughing and, you know, really getting into it. And then there's a moment where this, you know, French gay race car driver is revealed and absolute silence.
Yeah, depending on where you're watching the movie, it's either really shocking or a big laugh or both. But we kind of wanted that. You know, we felt like what would be the one guy who could step into Ricky Bobby's world and really shake it, and that would be a Formula One driver from France who happened to be gay.
Be careful, because tomorrow you're going to get beaten. Beaten real bad, cowboy.
Really?
Yes!
Well, and I want to know.
That's news to me.
Tomorrow you're going to be in trouble. I'm going to rip you into
things. Tell us a little bit about this foil, this race car driver, played by Sacha Baron Cohen, who plays Ali G on this sort of faux cable interview show where he's lured some of the world's great leaders to come on the show and answer really ridiculous questions. Yeah. What was happening in some of those moments where it was obvious you were improvising scenes together? Because there's a little bit of sort of unsettledness on the screen. You're nodding yes and laughing.
Yeah, that's why I love working with Adam McKay, is he will do the scene as written, which is, you know, usually the case in a comedy, and then you start to improvise and play around a little bit. But Adam will really let us just even go even further than a lot of other directors will. And there were moments where Sasha and I really didn't know what was going to happen, but he's so willing to take chances, and so am I, so it kind of shows up on the screen.
And then you throw the actor John C. Reilly in the mix, and all bets are off.
It's so good.
I got a new
it's
nickname,
so
the Magic Man. Now you see me?
No, you don't.
That was the stupidest nickname I've ever heard.
Is it, Ricky? Because I think you wish you thought of it.
All right, you got me. That's an awesome nickname.
I don't know if this is happening, but I'm assuming people are looking for all sorts of deep meaning and metaphor in NASCAR, which is used as a political metaphor. And you say no, you just sort of picked it because it seemed like a good thing.
Well, some things we have a little edge behind it and a little special intent here and there. But a lot of times, too, we're just really trying to make ourselves laugh, kind of selfishly. We don't really even think about the audience, what they might think is funny. We just trust that hopefully they think the same thing is funny.
Will Ferrell, I just want to ask you, big fan of Elf and a lot of your other roles, the cheerleader on Saturday Night Live, but the characters always do strike me as someone just determinedly hoping to find the best in people, you know, a guy who maybe breathes through his mouth, you know? Is there a time, is there something down the road that you might want to do differently? Or is this, hey, look at me, I'm in this wonderful place, and why mess with it?
I think comedy will always be a place I always live. That having been said, there are some other movies, Stranger Than Fiction, which is a film that comes out in November. That's a different movie for me. It's something played very close to the vest, even though there's a lot of comedy in the movie. It's probably the most kind of real performance I think I've given. So that'll be exciting to see what the reaction to that is.
You liked it.
I loved it.
That's actor, producer, and writer Will Ferrell speaking with us last August about his film Talladega Nights, The Ballad of Ricky Bobby, which is coming out on DVD on Tuesday. And listeners can catch his new film, Stranger Than Fiction, now. It's in movie theaters. And while you're there, there's, of course, always Sacha Baron Cohen's blockbuster Borat. You know, you just don't hear enough Journey anymore. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Sending all my love along the wire. They say that the road ain't no place to start a family. Right down the line, it's been you and me.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.